security officers guard the station. When the train gets to within 4 blocks of the station, the guards drive alongside, arresting migrants as they jump off and turning them over to La Migra. At mid-morning, Enrique sees 2 flashing red antennas. The boys jump off the train half a mile south of town. His friends pay for a taxi to the north side. Enrique goes in search of food. "We don't have any," people say. Finally, one person gives him an orange. Another gives him 3 tacos. He shares them with his friends. Until now, Enrique has opted to keep moving. In the south, in a pinch, he could pick mangoes that grow along the tracks. Once, in Chiapas, he survived on mangoes for 3 days. But here the countryside is too desolate and dry to live off the land, and begging is too chancy. There are no agricultural fields in sight, just factories that make glass and furniture. He needs to work if he is going to survive. Besides, he does not want to reach the border penniless. He has heard that U.S. ranchers shoot migrants who come to beg. He trudges up a hill to the small home of a brickmaker. Politely, Enrique asks for food. The brickmaker offers yet another kindness. If Enrique will work, he will get both food and a place to sleep. Happily, Enrique accepts. Some migrants say Mexicans exploit illegals by stiffing them after a day's work. Or they pay only a fraction of the going wage, which is 50 pesos, or about $5 a day. But the brickmaker does better than that, 80 pesos, and he gives Enrique shoes and clothing. For a day and a half, Enrique works at the brickyard, one of 300 that straddled the tracks on the northern edge of San Luis Potosí. Workers pour clay, water, and dried cow manure into large pits. They roll up their pants and stomp on the sloppy concoction, as if pressing grapes to make wine. When the slop becomes a firm brown paste, they slap it into wooden molds. Then they empty the molds on flat ground and let the bricks dry. The bricks are stacked into pyramids inside ovens as big as rooms. Under the ovens, the fires are stoked with sawdust. Each batch of bricks bakes for 15 hours, sending clouds of black smoke into the sky. Enrique's job is to shovel the clay. At the end of the day, covered in clay and manure dust, he bathes in a cattle trough. At night, he sleeps in a shed on a dirt floor he shares with one of his friends from the train. "I have to get to the border," Enrique tells him. Should he take another train? In all of his attempts, he has survived more than 30 train rides. This time, freight cars have brought him 990 miles from Tapachula near Guatemala. Is he pushing his luck? His employer says he should ride a Volkswagen van called a combi through a checkpoint about 40 minutes north of town. "The authorities won't stop a combi," the brickmaker says. Then he should take a bus to Matehuala, and he might be able to get a ride on a truck all the way to Nuevo Laredo on the Rio Grande. The Trucker. Enrique collects his pay, 120 pesos. He spends a few on a toothbrush. He hails a combi. It breezes through the checkpoint. He pays 83 pesos to board a bus to Matehuala. The desert is dotted with tall, crooked Joshua trees. A few people on the side of the road hawk snake skins. 3 hours later, a pink archway welcomes him to Matehuala. Outside the bus station, he sees a kind-looking man. "Can you help me?" Enrique asks. The man gives him a place to sleep. The next morning, Enrique walks to a truck stop. Matehuala is on a principal route for truckers headed to the United States. A convoy of trucks rolls by. Some truckers stop to eat or to gas up. "I don't have any money," he tells every driver he sees. "Can you give me a ride however far north you are going?" One after another, they turn him down. Many, having made the lonely haul from Mexico City, would welcome company for the remaining 380 miles to the border. Still, at least 9 in 10 truckers here, one trucker at the stop says, refuse migrants. If they said yes, police might accuse them of smuggling. Drivers say it is enough to worry about officers planting drugs on their trucks and demanding bribes. Moreover, some of the truckers fear that migrants might assault them. Finally, at 10 a.m., one driver takes the risk. Enrique pulls himself up into the cab of an 18-wheeler, hauling beer. Where are you from? The driver asks. Honduras. Where are you going? The driver has seen boys like Enrique before. Do you have a mom or dad in the United States? Enrique tells him about his mother. A sign at Los Positos says, checkpoint in 100 meters. The truck idles in line, then it inches forward. Judicial police officers ask the driver what he is carrying. They want his papers. They peer at Enrique. The driver is ready, my assistant. But the officers do not ask. A few feet farther on, soldiers stop each vehicle to search for drugs and guns. Two fresh-faced recruits wave them through. Oblivious to the chatter on the trucker's two-way radio, Enrique falls asleep. The scenery changes again. Joshua trees give way to low-lying scrub brush. The driver clears two more checkpoints. As he nears the Rio Grande, he stops to eat. He buys Enrique a plate of eggs and refried beans and a soda, another gift. Riding a truck, Enrique figures, is a dream. 16 miles before the border, he sees a sign, reduce your speed. Nuevo Laredo Customs. Don't worry, the driver says. La Migra check only the buses. A sign says, Bienvenidos a Nuevo Laredo. Welcome to Nuevo Laredo. The driver drops him off outside the city, near its airport, just past the Motel California. With the 30 pesos he has left, he takes a bus that winds into the city. Often, as he struggled to get through central and northern Mexico, Enrique came close to getting caught and deported. Time after time, his luck held. In Matias Romero, Oaxaca, Migra agents surrounded his train and caught many of the riders. Enrique jumped off and dashed to some bushes. He lay in the thicket, afraid to breathe. After what seemed like an hour, when the train began to roll, he sprinted alongside one of the cars and jumped back on. When the train reached Medias Aguas, Veracruz, and stopped briefly, Enrique climbed down and sat next to the track, talking to other migrants. But for the locomotive idling and a compressor cycling to feed the brakes, the night was ghostly still. "Don't you dare run," two men in green fatigues said, as they pinned him in the beams of their flashlights. A small army unit, based next to the train station, was out catching migrants. Enrique bolted. The soldiers chased him relentlessly. Though exhausted after nearly 2 days without sleep, Enrique outran both of them. He darted 2 blocks along the tracks toward the north edge of town to a dirt road called Miguel Hidalgo. Facing the rails was the backyard of a house. It looked empty. The house was built on 3-foot concrete pilings to keep it from flooding. He ran through the yard, fell to his stomach, and crawled under it. He waited. Nothing. It was midnight. Enrique ached with fatigue. He gathered some boards scattered beneath the house, stood them on their sides so no one could see him, and lay in the dirt. In seconds, he was asleep. The train coupled and uncoupled cars. It split the night with clanging and crashing, then slowly it pulled out, rumbling the ground as it passed behind Enrique and the house. Enrique heard nothing. He was safe. Surrounded by dirt, he slept. Now, as he winds his way into Nuevo Laredo, he has one more piece of good fortune. His bus stops at the Plaza Hidalgo, in the heart of Nuevo Laredo. It is a city park the size of a square block. There, under palm trees, the park is full of people. Some are migrants who sit on the steps of the big clock tower. Others are smugglers who circulate, offering in a whisper, to take people over to the United States for a good price. Enrique has no money. But he sees a man from Honduras whom he met on the train. The man takes him to an encampment along the Rio Grande. Enrique likes it. He decides to stay until he can cross. That night, as the sun sets, Enrique stares across the Rio Grande and gazes at the United States. It looms as a mystery. Somewhere over there lives his mother. She has become a mystery, too. He was so young when she left that he can barely remember what she looks like. Curly hair, eyes like chocolate. Her voice is a distant sound on the phone. Enrique has spent 47 days bent on nothing but surviving. Now, as he thinks about her, he is overwhelmed. 5. On the border. "You are in American territory," a Border Patrol agent shouts into a bullhorn. "Turn back." Sometimes Enrique strips and wades into the Rio Grande to cool off. But the bullhorn always stops him. He goes back. "Thank you for returning to your country." He is stymied. For days, Enrique has been stuck in Nuevo Laredo, on the southern bank of the Rio Bravo, as it is called here. He has been watching, listening, and trying to plan. Somewhere across this milky green ribbon of water is his mother. Enrique is challenging the unknown to find her. During her most recent telephone call, she said she was in North Carolina. He has no idea if she is still there, where that is, or how to reach it. He no longer has her phone number. He did not think to memorize it. Many of the youngsters from Central America and Mexico who go north on their own do not memorize telephone numbers or addresses. They wrap them in plastic and tuck them into a shoe or slip them under a waistband. Occasionally, kidnappers snatch the children, find the numbers, and call the mothers for ransom. Stripped of phone numbers and destinations, many of the children become stranded at the river. Defeat drives them to the worst this border world has to offer. Drugs, despair, and death. It is almost May 2000, nearly 2 months since Enrique left home the last time. He is a hardened veteran of 7 attempts to reach El Norte. This is his 8th. He has pushed forward 1,800 miles. By now, his mother must have called Honduras again, and the family must have told her that he was gone. His mother must be worrying. He has to telephone her. Besides, she might have saved enough money to hire a coyote who can take him across the river. He remembers one number back home, at a tire store where he worked. He will call and ask his old employer to find Aunt Rosa Amalia or Uncle Carlos Orlando Turcios Ramos, who had arranged his job, and ask them for his mother's number. Then he will call back and get it from his boss. For the 2 calls, he needs 2 telephone cards, 50 pesos apiece. When he phones his mother, he'll call collect. He cannot beg 100 pesos. People in Nuevo Laredo won't give. Mexicans along the border, he notices, are quick to proclaim their right to immigrate to the United States. "Jesus was an immigrant," he hears them say. But most won't give Central Americans food, money, or jobs. So he will work by himself. For migrant children, there are few options: shining shoes, selling gum or candy on the sidewalk, or washing cars. He'll wash cars. A refuge. The encampment he has joined is a haven for migrants, coyotes, junkies, and criminals, but it is safer for him than anywhere else in Nuevo Laredo, a city of 500,000, and swarming with La Migra and all kinds of police who might catch him and deport him. Worse than stuck, he would be back at the beginning. The camp is at the bottom of a narrow, winding path that slopes to the river. A clump of reeds hides it from constant surveillance by the U.S. immigration authorities. They watch with cameras and agents in white sport utility vehicles who patrol back and forth along a dirt road on top of a steep embankment along the far side. Enrique shares one of five soiled, soggy mattresses with three other migrants. Still others lie on pieces of cardboard. For their clothing, they use the closet, a wire spring standing upright from a mattress stripped of its ticking. Each resident of the camp has a space on one of the bare coils on which to hang his shirts and pants. Enrique smells excrement from goats and his fellow campers, whose bathroom is the surrounding grass. The camp is strewn with trash. Red ants cover the ground, and millions of gnats hover over the river. In the daytime, it is scorching hot. Each day he strips and wades in knee-deep to scrub away sweat and grime. When he is too afraid to venture into Nuevo Laredo to drink from a faucet in a park, he takes water from the river, which carries raw sewage from scores of towns. People tell him of a superstition. Drink from the Rio Bravo and he'll be stuck in Nuevo Laredo forever. He risks it anyway. The water tastes heavy, but it does not make him sick. The camp is a hard place for Enrique to sleep in. It is noisy all night with the sound of migrants coming and going as they try to cross the river. They swim or ride inner tubes to a tiny lush island in midstream, then rest and hide until they see a chance to make it the rest of the way. INS bullhorns bark, warning them back. Enrique can hear cars at a U.S. entry checkpoint a few blocks away. He knows he will have to cross if he ever wants to see his mother again. As he looks across the river, he can see a church steeple, train tracks, and three antennas with blinking red lights. He tries to summon his mother's calm voice. If only he could call her. Each evening, without fail, he summons his courage and goes to the Nuevo Laredo City Hall with a large plastic paint bucket and two rags. From a spigot on the side of the building, he fills the bucket. Then he goes to parking places across the street from a bustling taco stand. Unlike at other businesses, the workers at the taco stand do not run him off. One of his rags is red. Each time someone arrives to eat dinner, he waves the red rag to guide the customer into a parking space, like a ground crew member ushering a jetliner to a gate. Usually, there is competition. Two or three other migrants set up their buckets along the same sidewalk. Enrique approaches a woman driving a yellow Chevrolet Impala with chrome spoke wheels. She is talking on her cell phone. May he wash her car? She ends the call and declines. A man and his young daughter drive up. May I clean your car? No, son. The woman with the Impala returns with her tacos. Enrique waits until traffic is clear, then waves his red rag and guides her out. Suddenly, she reaches out her car window and presses 3 pesos into his hand. Enrique approaches dozens of people, but just one or two say yes. By 4 a.m., when the stand closes, he has eked out 30 pesos, or $3. A lifeline. The air around the taco stand fills with the aroma of barbecue. Enrique watches workers pull strips of meat from a vat, put them on large chopping blocks, and cut them up. Customers sit at long stainless steel tables and eat. Sometimes, when the stand closes, the servers slip him a couple of tacos. Otherwise, for his only meal every day, he depends upon the Parroquia de San Jose, or St. Joseph's Parish, and another church, the Parroquia del Santo Niño, the Parish of the Holy Child. Each gives food cards to migrants. One is good for 10 meals and the other for 5. Enrique can count on one meal a day for 15 days. The cards are like gold. Sometimes they are stolen and turn up on a meal card black market. Migrants who bathe in the river leave their cards on the bank and carry rocks into the water to throw at anyone who tries to take them. Each day, Enrique goes to one church or the other to eat. It is safe. The police stay away. Like clockwork, Leti Limon, a volunteer, swings open the double yellow doors at San Jose and shouts, "Who's new?" "Me, me," men and boys cry out from the courtyard. They rush to the door and jostle against it. "Get in line, get in line." Limon is poor herself. She cleans houses across the river in Laredo, Texas, for $20 apiece. But she has helped to feed these migrants for a year and a half, figuring that Jesus would approve. She issues the newcomers beige cards and punches the cards of those who enter. A parish priest counts 6% children. One by one, the migrants stand behind chairs at a long table. At the head is a mural of Jesus, his hands extended toward plates of tacos, tomatoes, and beans. Above him are his words, "Come to me, all you who are weary and find life burdensome." The lights dim, and two big fans spin to a stop so everyone can hear grace. In the still air, the room turns hot, nearly suffocating. Perspiration trickles down the migrants' faces and soaks their shirts. A volunteer or one of the migrants begins the short prayer. Some who have not eaten in 2 or 3 days cannot wait. From behind their chairs, they grab at the tacos with one hand, at bread with the other. A volunteer asks everyone to remove their hats, to please eat everything on their trays or give it to someone near them. Chairs screech as everyone pulls them out at once. Spoons of stew touch lips before bottoms hit the seats. There are more migrants than chairs. Some eat standing. Others squat on the floor, plates balanced on their knees. They eat in quiet desperation. In a clatter of forks against plates, beans, stew, tomatoes, rice, and donuts disappear. Afterward, opposite a portrait of the Virgin of Guadalupe, about a dozen of the migrants always gather around a map of Texas. It is covered in plastic, but fingerprints have blackened parts of it anyway. They tell how they will get there, and they discuss the state of the river. Is it high? Low? Then they sneak out an apple or a banana to give to a friend. At church dinners, Enrique meets other children who hope to reach their mothers in the United States. A 16-year-old boy, Hermes Galeano, is stuck too. He and Enrique compare stories. Both are from Honduras. Both have been robbed. As with Enrique, bandits on top of a train struck Hermes in the face with a board. It tore out his front teeth, leaving two black holes. As with Enrique, the bandits left him in his underwear sobbing and bloody. They ripped up his scrap of paper with his mother's phone number on it, too, and tossed it to the wind. Hermes's mother, Maria, left him for North Carolina when he was 10. She sent money, 5 letters, and 15 photos. She called every 2 weeks. It was not enough. Hermes missed the occasional 3-hour bus rides they had taken to Tegucigalpa to buy things, his mom's spaghetti, how they would go to the tortilla store together. He missed his mother's smell. After she left, he would put on her deodorant, stare at her picture, and cry. He slept in her bed, hoping to feel near her. Being raised by his aunt wasn't the same. "My mom told me she loves me. No one else ever told me that," Hermes says. This is his 3rd attempt to go to her. A 15-year-old girl, Mary Gabriela Posas Izaguirre, or Gabi, as she prefers, tells Enrique her story. She had reason to leave Honduras. Her mother, who was divorced, had sold the dining room table, the refrigerator, and the pots and pans to send Gabi to school. Finally, her mother had sold some of the beds. Gabi slept on the floor. Early one morning in July 1999, Gabi says, her mother snuggled next to her and hugged her. She had already spent half the night curled up next to her sons. When Gabi came home from school that afternoon, there was a note. "I'm going for a little while. I'm going to work very hard." Her mother left Gabi's older brother in charge and asked the children to pray 3 times a day. before they ate, slept, or went outside. Gabi and her two brothers ached for her. They began sleeping in her bed to feel near her. Gabi would drift off smelling her mother's scent on the pillow. She dreamed that her mother was at home scolding her in the morning, telling her to get to school on time. She imagined that they were going to the park. She missed teasing her for playing old fogey music, Beethoven. The house felt sad, empty, Gabi says. Every time the telephone rang, Gabi raced to answer it. "When are you coming home?" she begged her mother. Then she turned harsh. "Why did you bring us into the world if you were going to leave us?" Of 48 children in her class, 36 had a parent in the United States, most often a mother. At her new home in the northeastern United States, her mother cleaned house and babysat two toddlers. One day she sent Gabi a Barbie doll. The toddlers had already torn open the box. Gabi seethed. She sat alone envisioning her mother playing with her new charges. "How are the beaches?" she asked snidely. They argued. "I'm taking care of other kids instead of you. Can you imagine what that's like?" her mother demanded. "You don't know what I've suffered." Gabi didn't believe her. All she wanted was to be with her. Winter came. Her mother called crying. She was sick, lonely, and out of a job. "I knew I had to go," Gabi said. "I thought, I'm young, I want to help her, so she can come home." By Christmas of 1999, going had become an obsession. Her mother was terrified that Gabi would make the trip alone and be raped. She asked Gabi's aunt Lourdes, 26, to go with her. A smuggler promised to deliver them for $2,000 up front, but he robbed and abandoned them in Tapachula, just inside the southern border of Mexico. They were deported to Guatemala. Gabi resolved to try again, this time through the Lancandon jungle, in the Mexican state of Chiapas. She and Lourdes spent days washing clothes along the Usumacinta River in exchange for food, asking every smuggler who went by if he would take them through the mountain pass. "If you can't pay with cash," one said, "you know how women pay." Angrily, Gabi refused. Finally, four smugglers let them tag along with 80 migrants, who Gabi learned had paid between $5,000 and $8,000 apiece. They put her up front to help cut a path in the dense vegetation. She rebuffed constant demands for sex. She tried to look as ugly as possible. She hardly slept, never smiled, or combed her hair. Her legs turned black with ticks. She felt as though bugs were eating her alive, but she dared not lift her skirt to remove them. She kept repeating to herself, "I have to get to my mother." She and Lourdes switched to hitchhiking, but a Migra agent caught them trying to walk around a checkpoint. The agent was a woman, Gabi says, who ordered her to strip and checked her clothing for hidden cash, then scolded her for having so little money that there was no way for her to release them. "Please let us go," Gabriela begged. "I'm going to help my mother." "Váyanse, go," the agent said. Finally, Gabi and Lourdes made it to Nuevo Laredo. She tells Enrique she feels stuck here, too. Sometimes, she says, she wants to kill herself. Another Honduran teenager at church dinners is Kelvin Maradiaga. He, too, lost the phone number and address of his mother, Adelinda, in New York during his journey. Running from Mexican officials in southern Mexico, he fell into a puddle. His mother's phone number, jotted down with a felt-tip pen, blurred into oblivion. A man at a taco stand gave him a job washing dishes. He was able to buy a phone card to call Honduras to try to get his mother's phone number again. But the only phone in his small southern Honduran town, which belongs to an agricultural cooperative, had been disconnected. After months of travel, Kelvin fears he has only one choice: to go back to Honduras, get his mother's phone number, and attempt the journey all over again. "She would tell me about her problems. I would tell her about mine. I need to see her. I want to see her," says Kelvin. Outside the church after dinner, many migrants engage in a crude kind of street therapy. Who has endured the worst riding the trains? They measure trips not in days, but in shoes lost, beatings taken, belongings robbed. They show off scars. I walked 4 days. I walked 28 days. They air feet covered in large blisters, toenails that have turned up from walking. A young man sits on a green metal bench outside the church. He has been stuck here for weeks, and he trumps everyone. He slides up a leg of his black jeans and takes off a black, high-topped sneaker, then a prosthesis. His right calf tapers into a pink stump. A smuggler. For permission to stay in the relative safety of the river encampment, the leader, El Tarindaro, who is addicted to heroin, usually wants drugs or beer. But he has not asked Enrique for anything. El Tarindaro is a subspecies of coyote known as a patero, because he smuggles people into the United States by pushing them across the river on inner tubes while paddling like a pato, or duck. Others in the business keep clients in rented houses or hotel rooms. El Tarindaro is small-time. He uses the camp. Enrique is a likely client. In addition to smuggling, El Tarindaro finances his heroin habit by tattooing people and selling clothing that migrants have left on the riverbank. In a pinch, he reverts to his previous profession, petty theft. One day, Enrique bumps into El Tarindaro on the street. He has his arms around a live turkey he has stolen out of someone's yard. The smuggler has a short fuse when he needs a fix. He shoots up constantly. Enrique stares as El Tarindaro lies on a mattress, mixes Mexican black tar heroin with water in a spoon, warms it over a cigarette lighter, draws it into a syringe, and stabs the needle straight into a vein. When the drugs take hold, El Tarindaro hallucinates. He hears imaginary voices, crowds of people descending on the camp. Sometimes he is so slowed by heroin that he can barely get up or move. He can earn $2,000 to $3,000 in a single large smuggling operation, but blow it in a day on heroin, which he likes to mix with cocaine. He shares his drugs with friends in a local mob called Los Osos, named after a billiard cantina where they drink. Besides migrants, the camp has 10 perpetual residents. 7 are addicts. They call heroin la cura, the cure. A few at the campsite are Mexican criminals who have been deported by the United States. One is called El Lágrima, the tear. He is tattooed with TJ, a symbol of the Mexican mafia. A teardrop signifying a dead gang friend, and a spider web tucked next to his right eye. Also among the permanent campers are several migrants who are stuck. One, a fellow Honduran, has lived on the river for 7 months. He has tried to enter the United States 3 times. Every time he has been caught. He has descended into depression and a life of glue sniffing. Each time he tried to cross, he says, he went alone. Enrique listens. They call Enrique el hongo, the mushroom, because he is quiet, soaking everything in. Enrique clings to the camp where he is protected. Staying with El Tarindaro means the Los Osos bandits, who rob people under a nearby bridge and along the river, won't target him. Los Osos, once a group of neighborhood children who played along the river, became a band of 40 men who moved drugs and people across the Rio Grande. They began as pateros. Then they armed themselves with revolvers and knives. Anyone who wanted to cross this stretch of river had to pay Los Osos. Other pateros were threatened with death when they tried to cross clients in the area. Half of all migrants found drowned, autopsies reveal, died before ever entering the water, says Nuevo Laredo human rights activist Raimundo Ramos Vasquez. Other smugglers undercut Los Osos' business in the 1990s by using different spots to cross migrants along the river. Los Osos turned to smuggling bales of marijuana. Turf gunfights broke out on the river with other local gangs.
The homies,
the Parque Morelos, Los Peros, the Chiquillos boys, and Cuatro Vientos. El Tarindaro stuck with the less dangerous job of patero. Each week he gives police officers who patrol the river a 10% cut of his earnings as a smuggler. The police show leniency toward anyone at the camp. When the police arrive at the river, they ask Enrique for identification papers. They check his pockets for drugs. They help themselves to whatever change is there. Still, Enrique is spared the more severe shakedowns other migrants face. Leonicio Alejandro Hernandez, 33, says that four municipal officers approached him on the banks of the Rio Grande and said, "We charge 1,000 pesos, $100, to cross this river." Hernandez balked, and the officers lowered their price. "If you don't give us 500 pesos, 10 days in jail," he says one yelled. He says another warned, "Throw yourself into the river, and I'll kill you." Hernandez says he paid them and swam away. Octavio Lozano Gámez, the municipal police chief in Nuevo Laredo, acknowledges that of his 720 employees, a small minority of police officers in the city have this problem of robbing people. Lozano doubts, however, that even his corrupt officers would pick poor migrants to rob. Any smart police would seek out someone with more money, gold chains, wristwatches. Because he is so young, everyone at the camp looks after Enrique. When he goes at night to wash cars, someone walks him through the brush to the road. When he leaves during the day, someone always yells, "Be careful." They warn him against heroin. They offer tips on which parts of the city are thick with police, places he should not go. But leaving the camp scares him, and they give him marijuana to calm him down. Car washing goes poorly. One night he earns almost nothing. At 9:15 p.m., Enrique receives 2.5 pesos for helping a woman in a small station wagon back up. 5 minutes later, a woman in a blue dress arrives in a white Pontiac Bonneville. "May I wash your windows?" She nods and walks toward the taco stand. Enrique wipes the front of the car, then the side windows, moving his hand, with its fingers splayed across the back of a rag, in quick, ever-growing circles. He walks around the car, wiping and wiping, first clockwise, then counterclockwise. He cleans inside even the floorboards. The moon is out, but it is 90 degrees. Sweat trickles down his face. He must finish before the woman's tacos are ready. In minutes, he is done. She returns, fumbles for her car keys, gets in, then puts 2 coins, 3.5 pesos, in his hand. "Gracias," he says. A man tips him for guiding him backward out of a parking spot. "I hope this helps you, boy." Enrique thanks everyone. By 10 p.m., he has accumulated only 10 pesos, about $1. He sits over the open top of his water-filled bucket to cool off. Between then and 4 a.m., he scrambles after every car that pulls in. In 8 hours, he makes 20 pesos. The 15 days on his meal cards pass quickly. Now he needs part of his money to eat. Every peso he spends on food cannot go toward the phone cards. He begins to eat as little as possible, crackers and soda. Sometimes Enrique does not eat at all. He feels weak. Occasionally, local fishermen give him a fish they have caught. Friends at the camp share their meals. They offer scrambled eggs or a bowl of chicken soup. One teaches him to fish with a line coiled on a shampoo bottle. The line, fitted with a hook, has 3 spark plugs at the end to sink it. Enrique swings the spark plugs around his head, then casts toward the middle of the Rio Grande. The line whirs as it spools off the bottle. He hauls in 3 catfish. Even El Tarindaro is generous. The sooner Enrique can buy a phone card and call his mother, the sooner Enrique will need his services. When one of Enrique's meal cards is stolen, El Tirindaro gives him the unexpired card of a migrant who has crossed the river successfully. He knows that Enrique cannot swim, so he paddles him back and forth on the water in an inner tube to quiet his fears. When the river level drops, it exposes the lower branches of willows lining the banks. They are festooned with clothing that the migrants discard as they begin to wade out. Plastic bags, shorts, and underwear hang from the boughs like tattered Christmas ornaments. El Tirindaro takes Enrique on the inner tube along the bank as he collects the clothing. They wash the clothes in the river, then sell them near the taco stand and hawk any inner tubes they find for 15 pesos apiece at a tire store. El Tirindaro lets Enrique keep a t-shirt they find. Enrique learns that El Tirindaro is part of a smuggling network. He has partners in 3 safe houses on the U.S. side of the river, people who will hide migrants if Border Patrol agents are in pursuit. A middle-aged man and a young woman, both Latinos, meet him and his clients after they cross the river. Then they all drive north together, and El Tirindaro walks his clients around Border Patrol checkpoints, giving wide berth to the agents. After the last checkpoint, El Tirindaro returns to Nuevo Laredo, and the couple and others in the network deliver the clients to their destinations. The price is $1,200. El Hongo listens as his campmates talk about do's and don'ts. Find an inner tube. Take along a gallon of water. Learn where to get into the river, where not. They talk about the poverty they came from. They would rather die than go back. Enrique tells them about Maria Isabel, his girlfriend, and that she might be expecting. Enrique talks about his mother. He says he is extremely depressed. I want to be with her, he says, to know her. If you talk, it's better, a friend says. But it gets worse. He fears being attacked by bandits outside his circle of friends. He hears of atrocities, knives, a rifle to the chest, beatings with tree limbs, demands for shoes and money. Migrants huddle around the San Jose church, like cattle pressed up against a barn seeking protection from a cold winter chill. They share experiences. Gonzalo Rodriguez Toledo, 23, from Nicaragua, was approached by 2 middle-aged men on the river by Enrique's camp. They put a knife to his chest and robbed him. Oscar Vega Ortiz, 26, saw a man on a mule appear as he and 4 other migrants got ready to cross the river. The man pointed a rifle at his chest. Your money or your life, he told Vega. Manuel Gallegos prepares to have his last meal at the church before returning home to Mexico City. That morning, he took most of his clothes and shoes off to cross the river. Bandits spotted him. Gallegos ran, but the bandits, cursing, caught up to him and beat him with a small tree trunk. Gallegos's breathing is labored. He hikes up his shirt. His back is red and raw. Several ribs are broken. He will not try to cross again. One gang, Enrique knows, wants to harm him. Salvadorans with MS tattooed on their foreheads, the sign of the Mara Salvatrucha, hang out like dogs at the San Jose church, sniffing out robbery prospects. Unlike migrants, they wear new black Nikes. I'll pass you across the river, give me 200 pesos, they say to the unwary. Then they take their clients to the riverbank and assault them. After robbing them, they tell the migrants to keep mum about what has happened, or they will hunt them down and rape them. The glue sniffer at camp tangles with them, and Enrique steps in. One Salvadoran covered in tattoos threatens to thrash Enrique. He is spared only by the intervention of a migrant MS from his old neighborhood back home. But his luck with the authorities runs out. One afternoon, Migra agents come to the camp. They ask Enrique where he is from. I'm from Oaxaca, Enrique says in the accent he learned as he passed through. The agents pause. What are you doing here? Fishing, Enrique says, trying to stay calm. You can't fish here. You have to leave. Get out of here. He leaves only to be arrested in town. Twice. Both times for loitering. Where is he from?
Veracruz, Enrique says.
Get in, the officers yell, pointing to their squad car.
They call him a street bum and lock him up with three drunks who are singing. The toilet is running over, the drunks have smeared some of its contents on a wall, and the stench is overpowering. Both times Enrique wins his release by sweeping and mopping. One night, as he walks 20 blocks back to the river from washing cars, it rains. El Torindoro doesn't usually sleep at the river when it rains. The camp, Enrique fears, will be too dangerous without El Torindoro there. He ducks into an abandoned house. It has gaping holes in the roof. He finds some cardboard and places it on a dry spot. He removes his sneakers and puts them and his bucket near his head. He has no socks, blanket, or pillow. He pulls his shirt up around his ears and breathes into it to stay warm. Then he lies down, curls up, and tucks his hands across his chest. Lightning flashes, thunder rumbles, wind wails around the corners of the house. The rain falls steadily. On the highway, trucks hiss their brakes, stopping at the border before entering the United States. Across the river, the Border Patrol shines lights on the water, looking for migrants trying to cross. With his bare feet touching a cold wall, Enrique sleeps. Mother's Day. It is May 14, 2000, a Sunday when many churches in Mexico celebrate Mother's Day. Finally, Enrique has saved 50 pesos. Eagerly, he buys a phone card. He gives it to one of El Torindoro's friends for safekeeping. That way, if the police catch him again, they cannot steal it. I just need one more, he says. Then I can call her. Every time he goes to Parroquia de San Jose, it makes him think about his mother, especially on this Mother's Day. In addition to the refectory, on the second floor, are two small rooms where up to 10 women share 4 beds. They have left their children behind in Central America and Mexico to find work in El Norte, and they have found this place to sleep. Many of the single mothers pause at the 2,000-mile-long U.S.-Mexico border before making their final push into El Norte. Each could be his mother 11 years ago. They try to ignore a Mother's Day party downstairs where 150 women from Nuevo Laredo laugh, shout, and whistle, as their sons dance, pillows stuffed under their shirts to make them look pregnant. Upstairs, the women weep. Like Enrique's mother, these women feel sadness, guilt, and hope. One has a daughter 8 years old who begged her not to go. The girl asked her mother to send back just one thing for her birthday, a doll that cries. Another cannot shake a nightmare. Back home, her little girl is killed and her little boy runs away in tears. Daily she prays, "Don't let me die on this trip. If I die, they will live on the street." Lourdes Isaguirre, Gabi's aunt, arrives at the Rio Grande exhausted, worried, and crying. It has taken Isaguirre 3 months to get here. She cannot call home. Her family has no phone. She has walked away from Biron 5 and Melissa 10, as well as her 10-year-old sister and 11-year-old brother, whom she had been raising for her ailing mother. She is heading north to find work in the United States. "We try to keep each other from going crazy," says Águeda Navarro, 34, who left behind her children, 14 and 4, a few weeks earlier. Another mother, Belinda Cáceres, 29, prays that her children, ages 12, 9, and 2, will have enough to eat and will not get sick while she is gone. The mothers share the same fears. Will their children forget them? Will they see their children again? Back home, Isaguirre says, making Tommy Hilfiger-labeled shirts netted her $30 a week. It was not enough to feed her son and daughter each night, even when her ex-husband helped with the light and water bills. Biron, her son, went to a birthday party and saw a piñata.
He asked why he could not have a party too. Melissa, her daughter, needed books and school supplies. She asked why she could not have them. Isagire told them she would go to the United States and send money for piñatas and books. Melissa offered to quit school and go to work so their mother would not leave. "I'm going to work so you can study," Isagire told them. "I will never forget you." Now she fears that something will happen to them, and she will be too far away to comfort or help. Worse, she fears that the separation will last too long, and her children will give her the same icy reception she has watched other mothers endure. "You lose the love of your child," she says. She begins to cry. "I feel bad for doing this. It wasn't worth it. I'd rather starve with my children, but I've come this far. I can't go back." She mortgaged her property and borrowed money from a neighbor for her journey. Her voice turns firm again. "I can't go back empty-handed. I worry about dying along the way. I know going into another country is wrong. I know God would be against this. But I hope he understands." Many of the women in the room became single mothers because they were unwilling to endure the more difficult parts of their relationships with men. Drunkenness, beatings, mistresses. Alone, most found supporting their children difficult. Father Ovidio Neri Rodriguez, a priest in Tegucigalpa, explains, "To not prostitute themselves to feed their children, they leave." Though many mothers expect the separations to be short, typically they last 6 to 8 years, says Ana Luisa Espinosa, a Los Angeles Unified School District social worker who specializes in immigrants. By then they are strangers. Some mothers picking up children from smugglers hug the wrong ones. Enrique wonders, what does his mother look like now? "It's okay for a mother to leave," he tells a friend. "But just for 2 or 4 years, not longer." He recalls her promises to return for Christmas and how she never did. He remembers how he longed to have his mother with him each time his grandmother scolded him. "I've felt alone all my life. One thing, though, she always told him she loved him. I don't know what it will be like to see her. She will be happy, me too. I want to tell her how much I love her. I will tell her I need her." Across the Rio Grande on Mother's Day, his mother, Lourdes, thinks about Enrique. She has indeed learned that he is gone. But in her phone calls home, she never finds out where he went. She tries to convince herself that he is living with a friend. But she remembers their last telephone conversation. "I'll be there soon," he said. "Before you know it, on your doorstep." Day after day she waits for him to call. Night after night, she cannot sleep more than 3 hours. She watches TV, migrants drowning in the Rio Grande, dying in the desert, ranchers who shoot them. Enrique's disappearance stirs up a bad memory. Lourdes's ex-boyfriend and Diana's father, Santos, tried to make his way back to the United States after being deported to Honduras. He never arrived. Lourdes is convinced he was killed in Mexico or drowned in the Rio Grande. One of Lourdes's roommates has a relative who arrives at their apartment. He lies on the couch, recovering from the traumatic trip through Mexico. His smuggler loaded 150 migrants inside the tank of a truck that normally hauled gasoline. By the time the truck stopped, he tells Lourdes, several men had died of asphyxiation. Their tongues were hanging out. She imagines the worst and becomes terrified that she might never see Enrique again. She is utterly helpless. She asks God to watch over him, guide him. On the afternoon of the Mother's Day celebration, 3 municipal police visit the camp. Enrique does not try to run, but he is jittery. They ignore him. Instead, they take away one of his friends. Enrique has no money for food, not even for crackers. He takes a hit of glue. It makes him sleepy, takes him to another world, eases his hunger, and helps him forget about his family. He lies on a mattress and talks to the trees. He cries. He talks about his mother. I want to be near my mom. I want to be near to her, he says over and over again, until the fog in his mind lifts. A friend catches 6 tiny catfish. He builds a fire out of trash. It grows dark. He cuts the fish with a lid from an aluminum can. Enrique hovers nearby. You know, Hernan, I haven't eaten all day. Hernan guts the fish. Enrique stands silently, waiting. A setback. It is May 15th. Enrique has had a good night washing cars. He made 60 pesos. At midnight, he rushes to buy his second phone card. He puts only 30 pesos on it, gambling that his second call will be short. If his old employer finds Aunt Rosa Amalia and Uncle Carlos and gets his mother's number, it won't take many minutes to call his boss a second time and pick it up. Enrique saves his other 30 pesos for food. He and his friends celebrate. Enrique drinks and smokes some marijuana. He wants a tattoo. A memory of my journey, he says. El Torindaro offers to do it for free. He takes Enrique to a 2-bedroom house near the river, a Los Osos hangout, where El Torindaro sleeps when it rains. 2 drug addicts who live in the house use it to cook crack cocaine. 4 wealthier teenagers from Nuevo Laredo are sitting on couches in the living room, smoking crack they have just bought. El Torindaro shoots up to steady his hand. Enrique wants black ink, but all El Torindaro has is green. Enrique pushes out his chest and asks for 2 names, so close together they are almost one. For 3 hours, El Torindaro digs into Enrique's skin. In Gothic script, the words emerge, Enrique Lourdes. His mom, he thinks happily, will scold him. The next day, just before noon, he stirs from his dirty mattress. He borrows some toothpaste, squats at the river, dips his toothbrush into the murky water, and cleans his broken teeth. They still ache from the beating he took on top of the train a few weeks ago. So does his head, which throbs constantly. A dark pink welt, 1 inch long, scars his left forehead like a cross. He still cannot see well with his left eye, and the lid sags. His arms and legs are mottled with bruises, and he has been wearing the same clothes for days. He brushes gently, methodically, then cups water into his mouth, with his hands, and gargles. He washes his face, tosses water on his hair. He stores the toothbrush on his portion of the upright mattress coil. He is hungry. Hours pass. His hunger grows. Finally, he cannot stand it. He retrieves the first phone card from the friend who is holding it, and he sells it for food. Worse, he is so desperate that he sacrifices it at a discount for 40 pesos. He saves a few pesos for the next day and uses all of his money to buy crackers, the cheapest thing that will fill his stomach. Now he has gone from 2 phone cards to 1 worth only 30 pesos. He regrets surrendering to his hunger, if only he can earn 20 pesos more. Then he will go ahead and phone his old boss and hope that his aunt or uncle will call back so he won't need a second card. But someone has stolen his bucket. Without it, he is lost. He used it for sitting, chopping food, washing his feet, and earning a living. When he thinks about giving up, he tries to reassure himself. I know my day will come. I know I shouldn't get desperate. After his crackers, he lies on his mattress, stone quiet, and looks at the sky. His friend can see that he is depressed. Since Enrique has been at the river, he has watched 30 other men and boys sleep at the camp, pay a smuggler, then cross the river into the United States. The friend tries to cheer him up. He urges him not to despair. There is nothing left to do, the friend says, but to risk the cops, go downtown, and beg. They will do it together. They go to Avenida Guerrero. It is filled with tourists who spill across the border to shop, drink, dance, and hire prostitutes. Poor Mexicans flock there to beg. 5-year-olds tap the tourists on the arm and ask them to